Now, 2010 was proclaimed by the UN as the Year of Biodiversity. And in its statement, the UN points out that over the past half century, human activities have really put a heavy foot on the accelerator in and causing an unprecedented decline in biological diversity. It's said that species are now becoming extinct at 1,000 times the rate of the natural rate. The statement goes on to say that business as usual is not an option and that a new biodiversity vision is needed. Now, my next guest would wholeheartedly agree with that statement. He says that our health is dependent on the natural world and that we must protect the health and welfare of it to protect our own. Dr. Aaron Bernstein, Research Associate at the Centre for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School, and a paediatrician at Children's Hospital Boston, which is an affiliate of the Harvard Medical School. He also co-edits Sustaining Life, How Human Health Depends on Biodiversity. Aaron, welcome to our little wireless program.
Well, thank you for having me this evening.
I would like you to tell me about briefly about the Centre for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard, because as far as we can find out, it's the only one of its kind at a medical school in the U.S.
Well, that's our understanding as well. Our center focuses on the human health effects of global environmental change, be it climate change, the loss of biological diversity, the depletion of the ozone. And we very much feel that in order to address these changes to the global environment, people have to understand what's at stake for their health as a critical part of motivating action to address some of these major environmental concerns.
You did your early studies at Stanford in California, and that seems to be where you became interested in global environment. Did you cross paths with Paul Ehrlich?
I, in fact, did.
No comment.
Well, it is hard to be interested in these subjects and pass through the corridors of Stanford without encountering Paul, because he's a legend in the field. And what's remarkable about Paul Ehrlich in many ways is how you can talk to people all over the world in all walks of life who have either been influenced by his work or been taught, as I was, by him.
Yeah, I mention him, Aaron, because he's an old mate and he was on the program for an hour at the end of last year. Now, I spoke to a Ugandan wildlife vet, Gladys Kamina Zisoka,
yes,
on the program last week, and you would have met her.
That's right.
At Healthy Parks, Healthy People Congress. Her mission is to save the endangered gorillas of the Bwindi Impenetrable National Park by keeping them healthy from infectious diseases. And she's doing this, as you know, by trying to improve the health of the humans closest to them.
Yep.
Are you working on keeping our ecosystems healthy so that humans can stay healthy? Or is it sort of the same thing but the other way around?
I think it's a little more challenging in trying to do what Gladys does so extraordinarily well when it comes to identifying where the risks in nature are to new infections that may come into humans from animals. And I say that because if you look at so-called emerging infectious diseases of humans, and these subset of them are the new infections that have never been described before. Things like SARS would be an example, or even the H1N1 influenza. If you sort of track back how those, in both of those cases, viruses wound up getting into humans, you learn very quickly. It's hard to predict the sequence of events that led to their emergence, and as such, it becomes a much more difficult proposition to make sound judgments about how to prevent them. Now, there's some things that are obvious. Mixing domestic animals with wild animals is not a good idea. Drastically altering the habitat of species we know are reservoirs for potential for infections that may eventually get into humans. We know these things are not good ideas, and I think something's been there. But in instances such as SARS, we didn't know that the virus existed in its reservoir, which turned out to be a horseshoe bat, before the pandemic. And if you don't know it's there, you can't possibly prevent it.
I remember being made aware of the natural sources for Western medicine. When I was a kid, discovering that aspirin, for example, came from the bark, the bark of a willow tree.
Yep.
But I am astonished to learn from your work that over the past quarter century, more than half of all the new drug licenses issued by the FDA were given to compounds derived from natural sources.
Right. So that's excellent research that comes from David Newman and Gordon Craig. And they looked into that question. They actually found that, in fact, two-thirds of all new drugs licensed by the FDA between 1981 and 2006, that's over 1,100 compounds in total, were essentially wouldn't exist without nature either designing them directly or science sort of patterning the compounds off natural substances.
Tell the listener about the tree that fights cancer, the Pacific yew tree.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. So in the 1960s, the National Cancer Institute in the United States decided that it wanted to go on a scouting mission and look for compounds in all of the flora of the United States that may help treat cancer. And one compound that was discovered in this is a compound that has become an incredibly important cancer drug called Taxol. And Taxol was discovered in the bark of the Pacific yew tree. Now, there's a couple of important points about Taxol. One is that the Pacific yew tree, before the discovery of Taxol, was regarded as a trash tree. And it was routinely discarded in logging operations. It grew among much taller and much more sturdy conifers that were prized for their economic value in construction. And these smaller Pacific yew trees were, you know, these runty, craggy trees that were considered worthless, and in some ways less than worthless because they got in the way of harvesting the bigger trees.
Yeah.
But Taxol is a critically important drug because it treats cancer in a way that no drug had prior to its discovery. It acts by preventing the breakdown of what's known as the mitotic spindle. That's the thing that yanks chromosomes into daughter cells when cells divide. And no drug prior to the discovery of Taxol had done that. And when you treat cancer, it's critically important to try and kill a cancer cell using as many different tricks as possible, because if you use just a limited repertoire, cancer cells are very clever and they can escape. And so Taxol is critically important because it was able to add a new trick into our hat. And in fact, many drugs have been created that are even better than Taxol. They're slight modifications of the drug. And yet, here's this compound we didn't even know existed. We routinely discarded the tree, presuming it was worthless. And I think it's just a great example of how we have a hard time valuing our natural resources because we honestly don't know what we're losing with the loss of biological diversity.
And often there's not time to find out, because you point out that there are species that are driven to extinction even while they're being studied.
Right.
And this happened with a little creature from our neck of the woods, the gastric brooding frog.
Right. You're doing a fine job of leading me here. So this creature is extraordinary because there were two species of gastric brooding frog in the Queensland rainforest, and these frogs have their young gestate in the female stomach, and as you might imagine, that's a difficult proposition because frogs, like humans, secrete acid and enzymes to digest things in their stomach. They also make substances to propulse things out of their stomach into their intestines. And the tadpoles secreted a substance, or perhaps several substances, that interfered with all these processes so that it didn't get digested while gestating. And in fact, scientists had discovered at least one substance being secreted by these tadpoles that could have been tremendously useful for the treatment of, for example, ulcer disease, which affects 25 million Americans and perhaps 1 million Australians and perhaps other digestive disorders.
Mm.
But all research had to be stopped on the gastric brooding frog because it went, both species have gone extinct in the wild.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about another similar creature, the South American leapfrog, another example where amphibians have attributes when it comes to human health.
The South Is that the South American leapfrog?
The South American leapfrog.
The South American leapfrog. I don't claim to know anything about, I'm afraid.
Well, there's, look, what about the horseshoe crab?
The horseshoe crab, that one I can tell you about. So horseshoe crabs are essential to our well-being in several different ways. They've given us insights into how our eyes work, and what's amazing about horseshoe crabs is that they're ancient creatures, so they evolved probably 450 million years ago, meaning that they have survived two great extinction events in Earth's history, which very few creatures on Earth today have. And so their eyes are ancient, and in fact they look much more like the eye you might see on a housefly versus our eye, and yet they've given us critically important insights into how our eyes work. But they've in fact done much more for our well-being, because the blood of horseshoe crabs is used to detect the presence of bacteria, certain kinds of bacteria, so-called gram-negative bacteria, that may contaminate injectable medicines, including things like vaccines, but also the presence of bacteria on implantable devices in humans, like heart valves. And so this creature, which looks frankly like something from another planet, they have perhaps, depending on how you count, 9 eyes, 6 pairs of legs, blue blood, you know, eyes that look like a fly, and yet they have proven tremendously valuable to both understanding vision and to safeguarding, particularly vaccines.
I like the way Aaron Bernstein chuckles while he's answering questions on Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. And Aaron is the boss of the Harvard Medical School's project, which is looking at biodiversity and its importance to human health. A number of breakthroughs have come from studies involving venomous peptides produced by sea snails. As you can see, I'm just grabbing examples at random here.
Well, you caught me a bit off with the frog, but
I think I made that frog up, actually.
I think the snails you refer to, cone snails, are particularly relevant to Australians because, in fact, they surround the shores of Australia. And so these creatures, they're about, we think about 700 species in the genus, and each species makes 100 to 200 peptide toxins. Now, peptides are sort of miniature proteins. And each species' peptide complement is unique, so there may be as many as 100,000 peptides in all. We've probably characterized a few hundred of these in any detail. And in fact, several of them have already been absolutely essential to us better understanding how our brains work, which is a remarkable thing. But it turns out that there is a sort of common currency to all life, and the snails use these peptides to paralyze the nervous system of their prey, or paralyze their prey by essentially assaulting the nervous system. They eat fish and worms. This is quite useful to them, of course, because they're snails and move about as slowly as the proverbial snail, and therefore they need to rapidly immobilize things like fish if they're to eat. But the way that they do what they do to their prey is by essentially binding and blocking various kinds of cell membrane receptors, like what we call calcium channels and potassium channels. And it turns out that these calcium, potassium, and other kinds of channels in their fish and worm prey are essentially the same ones that can be found in human nervous systems. And so these peptides have been harnessed to better understand how the nerves in humans work. And what's even more remarkable is that one of these peptides has already been transformed into a drug called seconotide, which is a painkiller and has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States for the treatment of chronic nerve pain. And it's really the greatest breakthrough in the treatment of chronic pain that medicine has made since the invention of the opiates, which was a long time ago.
Wow. Well, it's a great pity we can't spend the rest of the program talking, because we've only just started this. You make the point that we've got to learn to love microbes as we do whales, that the charismatic megafauna are splendid creatures, but it's in that microbial world that we may find our salvation.
Yeah, it turns out one thing I should leave your listeners with is that, you know, when you hear the word biodiversity, you tend to think of colorful birds and pretty fish and things in zoos. And those are, in fact, key elements. But it turns out that if you look at the substrate of life, and by that I mean the genetic substrate of life, the vast majority of diversity is found in the microbial world. And in fact, most bigger life forms, including us, would cease to exist if it weren't for the diversity present in these other organisms. And so it's important that when we think about the ongoing loss of biological diversity, that it is, yes, it's critical to address the loss of species, but we also need to think about the loss of genes from populations of big species or from ones we can't even see.
Good on you, Aaron. Aaron Bernstein, Research Associate at the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He's the co-editor with Eric Chivian of Sustaining Life, How Human Health Depends on Biodiversity, which is published by Oxford University Press. LNL on ABC Radio National, and after a little bit of music, David Matthews is going to tell us about his absolutely remarkable dad.